Hello and welcome to another edition of Digital Flotsam. I'm P.W. Fenton. And what you're listening to right now is my brand new theme music, created for me by the fabulous indie band Three Blind Mice. I can't thank those guys enough. I am crazy about it. My only regret is that I only get to play it twice a show. This is a show about close encounters. The music I should play here is pretty obvious, but of course I can't. So I've decided instead to play the sound of a lovely bird singing, my own Quaker parrot, Satchel. Take it away, Satchel.
In the scale of 1 to 10, I'd probably have to give that probably a 2 for me.
I felt like you didn't go for it, and I know that you're capable of doing that. I just wish you would have broken out a little bit more.
Oh, God, I thought that was absolutely dreadful.
Okay, John Williams, sue my damn bird. Good morning, Satchel. Satchel is actually a female. I thought he was a male until he started laying eggs. The name stuck, though, and she also likes Dixieland, so Satchel was a good name. Well, back to Close Encounters. I'm not talking about being buzzed by space aliens. I'm talking about close encounters with celebrities. When you live in New York City, you have a distinct advantage when it comes to close encounters. Just walk through the streets, and you're more likely to encounter a celebrity than anyone walking around Atlanta or St. Louis or Chicago or maybe even L.A. For New Yorkers, close encounters are commonplace. Geez, if you can mortgage your home and afford a ticket to a Broadway show, virtually any seat in the house is a close encounter. In a Broadway theater, you could probably hit any performer with a spitball. Now, please don't do that. I'm just saying that as an illustration. I'll start with a close encounter from the early 60s. The Beatles had come to America. Now, I didn't attempt to see them in person the first time they were here. I did see them later at Shea Stadium in 65, I think. But that was a rather distant encounter. But the time I'm talking about now, they were appearing on the Ed Sullivan Show. And one of the artists who appeared on that same show with them was the UK vaudevillian artist Tessie O'Shea. Well, one day around the time of that first appearance, my future wife and I were walking by the theater where the Ed Sullivan Show was broadcast, and who should walk out the door but Tessie O'Shea? Uncharacteristically, I'm actually fairly shy, I spoke up. Miss O'Shea, we love your work. She immediately stopped and invited us to tea. That was amazing enough, but she invited us to the famous Russian Tea Room, a place that I wasn't even sure I could afford to check my coat, no less have tea. And that's where I first learned an important rule of New York social etiquette. If someone invites you somewhere, they are paying. She was a wonderful and gracious hostess. A really great memory. In those days, my future wife and I were aspiring actors, although in those days, a female was still called an actress. In fact, my future wife, Roz, was attending the High School of the Performing Arts, called PA by those in the know. This was the high school featured in the hit movie Fame. You know the one where all the kids are dancing in the streets? That one. That school in itself was a source of close encounters. My wife's drama teacher was the late director, author, actress Vinette Carroll. Her classmates included people like Ben Vereen, Dom DeLuise, David Landau, better known as the guy who played Squiggy. Well, anyway, we were both interested in the Broadway scene. So we would do something we called second acting, It was pretty easy. Using this technique, we got to see every Broadway show from the second act on for free. Simple. The key was dressing up. Real patrons dressed up for the theater. So I would dress in a suit and tie, and Roz would dress in a nice black dress. We would go to a theater where a new show was playing, and we would wait for the intermission after the first act. Traditionally, at that point, the theater lets out all the smokers. So all the folks who had been watching the show would spill out onto the sidewalk in front of the theater to enjoy a smoke break before the second act. Roz and I would walk up and mingle into the crowd and smoke a cigarette. And when the marquee lights flashed on and off, signaling the end of intermission, we would saunter in with the rest of the crowd as though we were from the theater. We'd hang back just long enough to be last in line, and then we would quickly scan the theater for empty seats and take them. Sometimes we couldn't sit together, but who cared? We got to see Broadway shows for free. But we were even bolder than that. Sometimes we would sneak backstage or talk our way backstage in an attempt to meet the actors. Once, after seeing a play called Love, starring Eli Wallach and his wife Ann Jackson and Alan Arkin, we went to the stage door and made up some story we thought might convince Eli Wallach to talk to us. Of course, it was obviously bogus. But much to our surprise, the stage door opened and the dude said, "Follow me to Mr. Wallach's dressing room." Eli Wallach was extremely gracious. He talked to us at length about our ambition to be actors and about the play he was just in. And then he did something totally unexpected. Maybe it was crafted to politely inform two intelligent young people that they were intruding. Maybe it was not. But he said, "My wife and I are going to do some Christmas shopping this evening. Would you like to come with us?" We declined, of course, but my mind will be eternally blown. Next comes an example of something that could never happen again in New York City. The world has become a much more security-conscious place. We used the suit and tie trick, or we tried, at NBC. We had heard Johnny Carson mention that the studio where The Tonight Show was taped was on the sixth floor in what was then called the RCA building. We also knew that the show usually taped in the afternoon. So it was around the time that the show would probably be taping, so we decided to see if we could find our way into the studio. We walked into the lobby of the building at the entrance that had NBC on the marquee. There was a group of elevators, and one had its door open. We walked calmly and confidently into it. We were startled, however, when a man said, "What floor, please?" "Six," I said. He looked at us and said, "You can't go to that floor. That's one of the studios." "Oh, that's where we want to go." It wasn't working. The elevator operator simply replied, "You have to have tickets, and you can only get them through the mail." We walked out of the elevator defeated. We blew it. As we walked away, we walked by a plain, unmarked door. Roz turned the knob. It was open. She stuck her head in. I think we were both expecting it to be a mop closet or something. She turned back smiling and said in a whisper, "Stairs." We both stepped in and quickly closed the door. Well, it was worth a try, we thought, and we began climbing the stairs. We were young and fit, and we were there in no time. We paused at the sixth-floor landing to catch our breath and build up our nerve. I expected the door to open into a hallway or something, but we opened the door and stepped into a large room. There were several people in the room, some milling about, some sitting on a group of sofas drinking coffee. Nobody seemed to pay any attention to us at all. We could hear the Tonight Show coming over some speakers, and then noticed a couple of TV monitors, so we were somewhere near the right place. A door on the opposite side of the room opened, and someone came through it, and you could hear an audience applauding briefly as it closed. We looked around at our surroundings, and we began to recognize some of the folks sitting on the sofas. There was Phyllis Newman, one of the Tonight Show's perennial guests, and on another sofa sat her husband, writer Adolph Green, and his collaborator, Betty Comden. We were backstage. We were in the green room. We couldn't believe it. Nobody was challenging us, and we were backstage at the Tonight Show. We eventually got brave and poured ourselves some coffee and sat down on the sofas. The celebrities smiled at us and acknowledged our presence, but luckily never struck up a conversation with us. We just listened. At some point, we learned that they were all disappointed that Johnny wasn't there. Johnny Carson had the flu or something, and the producers had gotten Sammy Davis Jr. to sit in as host on short notice. I think he was playing in the play Golden Boy at the time. Just then, the door on the other side of the room opened up and was held open by someone. We could hear the closing theme music playing and the crowd applauding. All eyes turned towards the door and everyone stood up, so we did too. In walked Sammy Davis Jr., who then walked through the room shaking everyone's hands and thanking them, including the two of us. He even chatted with Roz and I for a few minutes. I don't remember the conversation clearly, but I'm sure we introduced ourselves as budding young actors. He was short, noticeably shorter than me, and I'm pretty short. And I was struck by a large scar on his nose. I had never noticed it on TV or in the movies, but it was an almost squarish patch of lighter colored skin on the bridge of his nose. Later, when I read his biography, Yes, I Can, I learned that was from the terrible automobile accident he survived in 1954 that cost him his left eye. People were picking up their belongings and getting ready to leave, and since we had no idea where to go or what to do, we quietly slipped out the same door we came in and ran down the stairs and out into the street. Another of those close encounters involves arguably the greatest name in jazz to ever exist. I was once walking down a street near Times Square in New York, and I came upon Louis Armstrong. He was dressed in a big black overcoat with a furry collar, and he looked like a million bucks. That's something striking about celebrities. Even when you meet them on the street, they seem as though they have an actual spotlight focused on them, as though they glowed. And certainly, Louis Armstrong deserves to glow. The next close encounter is a little more involved. I was in an off-Broadway play with my future wife, Roz. The play was a revival of the very successful play and later movie, Come Blow Your Horn. In the play, she was playing the girlfriend of my older brother, and we had no scenes together. During one of our performances, I had a scene with the actor playing my older brother, and suddenly I went blank. I had no idea what the next line was. Now, I am fully prepared to take full blame for this, but it hardly even matters since at the very same moment, the guy playing my brother lost all contact with the play as well. Add to this that we were playing theater in the round. There was audience on all four sides of us. There was no way for somebody to whisper the next line from off stage. Well, we did what actors do in such incredibly terrifying situations. We improvised. We started a conversation based on our knowledge of the show and of the characters. At one point, the guy playing my brother devised an excuse to walk off stage. Maybe he was going to check the mail. I don't remember. All I know is that he left me on stage all alone with no freaking idea what I was supposed to do. I don't know how, but I actually survived that. I don't remember what I did to fill the time. I must have done something. But soon, the actor playing my brother was back, and he plopped himself into a chair and began to read a book. He made up some line about how I should learn to read a book once in a while. Maybe I'd learn something. He held up the book and said, "Look, no pictures." I looked at the book he was reading and instantly saw that he had a copy of the play tucked into it, and he was flipping the pages, trying to figure out where we were. But since we were arguing in the scene before we went blank, I asked, "Well, what do you think I should do?" His reply was, "Well, why don't you ask me blah, blah, blah?" I don't remember exactly what the line was, but it was the line that led us both back into the play and saved the day. Now, that's an interesting story in itself. But the interesting story is what followed. After the show was over, I had a visitor to my dressing room. It was an actor named Dave Gill, who had once played my part in the original Broadway production. He happened to be in the audience. I was mortified. He said, "I remember this show quite clearly, but there was a scene in the second act tonight that I didn't recall at all. It was the best, most character-revealing scene in the whole play. Where did that come from?" It was the scene we made up in a complete panic. I worked for a good while in New York as a freelanced photojournalist. And during that time, I had a great many close encounters with celebrities of all kind. There's a great example of that on my blog. Look for an entry called October 15th, 1969. But my greatest close encounter ever occurred in 1967. I had business in Manhattan that put me in Times Square every day. Like so many millions of Americans before me, I walked through the Great White Way every day. Well, this particular day, I was on my way to the subway entrance near the southeast corner of Broadway and 42nd Street. There's a newsstand on that corner, and I decided to stop there and get a paper to read on the way home. I reached down and grabbed a newspaper from the stack and turned towards the proprietor to pay for it when I realized someone else had grabbed the same paper with the same intention. I quickly turned back and stared into the face of the guy who was holding the opposite edge of the same newspaper. It was Muhammad Ali. He was, at that time, in his prime. He had just been stripped of his title for refusing to be drafted into the army, and he was beautiful. I let go of the paper, I extended my right hand and said, "Hello, champ." He smiled and shook my hand, paid for his paper, and walked away. I couldn't get the grin off my face for the whole commute.
Muhammad Ali. He was the greatest the world's ever seen. The heavyweight champ who came back again. Got the gift of the gab, knew how to fight. Had everybody beat, way out of sight. Said the man of the 20th century. I'm the Louisville Lip, Muhammad Ali. Muhammad, Muhammad Ali. He floats like a butterfly, stings like a bee.
Life in New York was an endless string of close encounters like that one, where you would frequently see somebody famous sharing the same sidewalk. Most New Yorkers, myself included, seem to go out of their way to act like they don't even notice. My mind might be saying, damn, that's Woody Allen and Diane Keaton. But my face offers only a glance and a glimmer of recognition. I like to believe that it's out of respect for their privacy. Maybe it's more than that. Maybe it's an ego boost for New Yorkers to see a celebrity and act like it's no big thing. It is deemed unsophisticated and touristy to confront celebrities for autographs and such. I believe that most celebrities actually enjoy New York City for that very reason. New York City is a place that allows you to be alone in a crowd, even when you're a celebrity. Don't get me wrong, there are plenty of celebrities that I would love to get to know personally. But on a busy street, when Morgan Freeman is trying to hail a cab outside the Winter Garden Theater, it's no place to strike up a potential lifelong relationship. There, I think a simple smile and a nod will convey everything you could hope to convey in such circumstances. So there you have it, another edition of Digital Flotsam. My humble apologies to anyone who might have played this Close Encounters edition thinking it would be an account of being rectally probed by kidnapping space alien, but that edition, if I ever have the guts to do it, will be entitled Aliens I Have Known in the Biblical Sense. Thanks once again to Three Blind Mice for gifting me with this wonderful new theme music. You can find detailed information about them and everything else you heard in this edition in the show notes at digitalflotsam.org.
And Peter holded the microphone.